Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Smith and Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. And Jonesy, we're going to dive right into it. It's been arguably the biggest story in the NBA, and it centers around allegations. And again, we say allegations at this point, centered on Toronto Raptors big man Ajante Porter, who has missed the last couple of games due to personal reasons. The team has not said anything else other than that, but there are reports swirling and circulating alleging that Ajante Porter was betting on himself. I mean, that's a term and a phrase that we've heard for a long time in the city, Jonesy, when it comes to Fred VanVleet and his battle cry and mantra and just sort of his path to the NBA. But it's now become a real thing, I suppose, at least in terms of the allegations that are out there, that Ajante Porter was involved in at least two separate occasions involving prop bets, involving himself, and what's his role in all of this. To try and dig through fact, fiction, or otherwise, and make sense of what could come if it is found out that Ajante Porter is guilty of some of these allegations that are out there. We bring into the conversation a man that's known Porter for a long time, and he currently works as a writer and author for Front Office Sports, Alex Schiffer. Alex, as it stands right now, what do we know versus what is sort of fact, fiction, conjecture in terms of where the story is at right now and what still needs to be confirmed and uncovered and the next steps? I mean, I know I'm throwing you about seven questions at a time there, but it's a very complex story and issue, to say the least.
Yeah, for sure. I guess let's start out with what we know. We know Ajante Porter is still a member of the Raptors. He's under investigation by the NBA for irregularities with his prop bets. And there were two instances, one in January against the Clippers, one in March against the Kings, in which his unders or his prop lines all hit on the unders. He was projected to come in and, you know, I'm forgetting the exact numbers, but call it, you know, like maybe 5-5-5 or something around those numbers, nothing crazy. He exited after a few minutes and didn't come close to those numbers. So so he hit on the under for all of those, if you were to parlay it. And that has arose the suspicion of the NBA and also gambling companies. And those 2 days were also where his money lines were the top, or his bets were the top money maker for bettors using, I believe if it was DraftKings or FanDuel. I want to say it was DraftKings. What we don't know was Ajante Porter fully aware of his lines for his prop bets for that night? Did he make the bets himself? Did he have somebody make them for him? Was the account in his name? Was it an associate of his? Is this all somehow a very bizarre coincidence? I think that is what is at the heart of this that remains to be seen and will probably determine his fate.
Alex, you never really know. You know, the old adage is the more you know, the more you don't know. And you have been covering both Michael and Ajante Porter's careers for what, you know, quite some time now, guessing like 9-10 years. Did you see anything in either of them that would have led you to believe that they could have slipped into this abyss or something like this was, I don't know, potential? I mean, like I said, you never really know, but what do you know of them and as basketball players and as people having covered them for that long?
Yeah, you know, specific to Ajante, I'd say, he's always been the Porter brother who has an interest in finances and money and tech. You know, I remember him being able to fix phone screens for his classmates and his teachers when he was in high school. You know, he was early into the crypto stuff and things of that nature. I think he was, you know, messing around with like an investment fund or hedge fund type thing at some point. So he's always been the tech numbers guy, you know, of the family of the seven siblings or however many it is. And so that's why I'd say, you know, if you were to tell me something like this would happen, I would say, I was about to say put my money on, but that'd be a stupid joke. I would say he's likely the one. But you have to remember, you know, I started covering these guys long before sports gambling ever became legal, and it was on the table to become legal, and daily fantasy sports were just kind of emerging, you know, around the time that they were going to college. So I never would have guessed, you know, 9, 10 years ago, whatever it might have been now, that you know, one would be caught up in a gambling scandal of any sort. But, like, Jonte is the kid in the family who's always been, you know, interested in numbers and finances and those types of things, if that makes sense.
Alex, I don't know how much you know of this. I think details are kind of coming out almost on a daily basis. If somebody's listening to this interview a couple of days later in podcast form or something, there might be new details that we're not even talking about right now. But I understand that there's been some stuff now reported about screen grabs that were taken from a Discord chat where it's alleged that it was Jonte Porter that was in the Discord chat, and this person that again allegedly was Jonte Porter has since tried to delete his name or delete his screen name, and it's still being attributed to him in this chat, which is leading some people to believe that there's proof in this what was supposed to be private chat that it was Jonte. Like, I don't know how much you know about that stuff, but like, where the next steps might be for the league, let alone for whomever is investigating, to truly actually be able to concretely say, yes, indeed, it was him and he did this.
Yeah, you know, full transparency, I'm not really a Discord guy and I'm not a better. So this has been
Nor
a huge education for me as this has all gone on. Yeah, it's been an education for all of us, right? So, you know, if that is true, it doesn't sound like he is doing himself any favors. I don't know the nature of Discord enough to where the legal, is it immune from certain things or not? But I'd say potentially destroying evidence in any case doesn't sound like something I would advise. You know, and I would just kind of say, you know, the what I do know about prop bets and NBA bets and whatnot, you know, to me this kind of is the equivalent of betting on Garrett Temple, right? The Raptors guard who's a veteran end of the bench type guy. I think that some of that stuff is kind of easy to get caught with, just because how many people go into a game, you know, I mean, when you go into a game, if I were betting on a game, I would say if the Raptors were playing maybe a team like the Pistons who are terrible, or the Spurs even, like, maybe I would bet on some of those end of the bench guys just because they might get in if the game gets out of hand enough. But, you know, it's so per chance of, does an injury happen and one of those non-rotation guys come in? Does someone get ejected maybe and someone's getting more run than they were expecting? So I've always kind of thought that, you know, if you were betting on the lines for a guy who usually isn't a regular contributor, you're maybe kind of playing with some fire just because the odds of them getting in the game for any significant amount of time to register stats is a whole conundrum in itself, right? So I feel like if what is out there is reported to be true with some of this stuff, and even just the idea that he was aware, I feel like he sort of made it very easy to get caught, and those screen grab reports, if it is true, it doesn't do him any favors there.
Alex, it's interesting. There was a little snippet on ESPN about his brother, Michael, you know, defending him, you know, after the game against the Suns. You know, he says, I highly doubt he would do anything that put his career in jeopardy. You know, and I expect him to say that, knowing his brother like that. But is there somewhere where there could have been a transfer of information innocently that might have led to this, where all of a sudden, I mean, it's funny to look at it being the biggest payout on DraftKings, and it's a coincidence. I just, you know, he's not a marquee guy. You know what I mean? It's not like betting on, as you said, LeBron or something like that. It's a guy who's, you know, into the bench. To me, it's terrible that he's been tagged and associated with this. But I mean, what role does he play in his own demise? If that's the question at heart here.
Yeah, you know, to me, if this would mark the end of his career, I think it's a very sad story in that he played a year at Missouri. He was SEC, I think, sixth man of the year. He showed a ton of promise. He was supposed to come back his second year while his brother went to the draft in order to kind of show he can be the guy and maybe get his draft stock up. He tears his ACL, right, in a secret scrimmage before the season started. He re-tears it as he was rehabbing, and, you know, his injury, his career kind of got derailed from there. He spent a lot of time in the G League, and the Raptors were the first team to give him some run. I think that that's a I thought he was a really feel-good story this year, and what's kind of been a rebuilding year for the Raptors, and that this guy who couldn't get on the court and had some really tough breaks found a way to kind of start to carve out his niche in the NBA, and I thought that maybe there was a chance that he would stick there and, you know, start to get, you know, make salvage what he could that was left of his career. You know, as for his brother's involvement, I mean, you look at the times that the dates in which these things allegedly happened, and it's not like the Nuggets had played either Sacramento or the Clippers anytime near the Raptors had. So I don't think Mike has anything to do with this. To your point, I would expect him to defend his brother. I think we'd all stick up for our sibling in a tough time like this. Like, what's he going to do? Go up there and say, like, yeah, he's guilty? These two have been attached to the hip essentially since they were kids. So I don't think Mike has anything to do with it other than that, you know, it's his brother and he's kind of being dragged into the public sphere with this, into the news cycle with this, given he's on defending champs. He has a big role there. And his brother's in the center of a huge gambling investigation.
I'm going to throw, again, another six or seven questions at you all in one, Alex, and I'm going to essentially steal a line from one of our colleagues. Michael Grange wrote a piece on sportsnet.ca, and I'm going to present it to you, and for that matter, Jonesy, to you as well. The one thing, I guess, that we don't know, which is a huge thing, at least, again, at this point right now, we still have to continue to say allege, because we don't know what actually did or didn't happen. And here's, to me, where it gets confusing and it's hard to even have this conversation, Alex, is, did he do this alone? Did he do it willingly? Was he coerced? Was he involved in some sort of organized crime scheme? What are we talking about here? Was it a simple misunderstanding? Was it a mistake? Like, there are so many layers to this that we just don't know. And I don't know if the answer to any one of those questions will ultimately make a big difference or no difference at all to how the league ultimately views this. And I would add another layer to this, maybe, Alex, is to that point of, will it matter to the league? I say this with all due respect. He's still one of 450-odd players in the league. There are only a handful of people that can say they are NBA players. But would it be easier, quote-unquote, to make an example of a guy that is a end-of-the-bench journeyman-type grinder who's trying to find his way in the league, as opposed to what's happening in Major League Baseball with a superstar player and trying to figure out what do we do with, you know, player X, who is a multi-time all-star, multi-time champion, superstar, and how the heck do we navigate these waters? It might be easier with a lesser-known guy.
Yeah, you know, I have a couple of thoughts there, maybe more than a couple. One, I think, yes, I think that it would be a lot easier for Adam Silver to deal with this if it were Jonte Porter than LeBron James. And, you know, maybe if this were to end up in some way of him getting banned or whatever, I think it might end up being a trivia question in 10, 15 years. Who was the first player to get banned in the NBA from gambling? Because, as you said, he's such a non, you know, if Michael Porter Jr. were just an average NBA rotation player, not a borderline all-star, I kind of wonder how many out of every 10 fans would know who Jonte is, or even who Michael is, let alone Jonte. So I think it is very easy for him to get an example made. I've just given the status. He's a two-way player. He's not a crucial piece of the Raptors roster or anything like that. So I think from that perspective, you're correct. And I think just in general, I think the NBA is sort of at a crossroads here where we're at a point where league pass is starting to get gambling options added into it in real time. You know, players are complaining about being treated like, you know, being treated the way they have by fans over parlays and whatnot. And Adam Silver's really pushing for more of this, but he now has this mess on his hands. I don't know if this is a come-to-Jesus moment for the NBA, but I do think that there needs to be some ideas of where does gambling fit in the league going forward? And is there anything that's going to be done to maybe protect the players more from fan interactions? No, I have a lot of friends who gamble, and I feel like it's changed from did the Raptors win to did I hit my parlay? And, you know, that's, the players probably take the biggest brunt of that. So I do think that maybe this is the moment that, you know, there's a timeout called and some things are reassessed as to where this is going to be with the league going forward, what needs to change, and maybe to kind of slow the brakes on some of this stuff, because clearly if this didn't happen now, it wouldn't have surprised me if it was happening in a couple months, a couple of years, et cetera, just based on the current climate.
Alex, the way I look at this is, you know, that genie's out of the bottle. And I don't know, because of the monetary stake and as much money as being made, I don't know if that genie's ever going back in the bottle. So it is an issue. And how does the NBA try to regulate it? They've told, you know, players, you know, people that work with the organization, work in the league, you can't be part of it. But, it brings to mind some of the old drug movies where it's okay to sell the drugs, just don't smoke them, you know? And gosh, it makes it really, really tough right now. Is there any kind of a solution out there, Alex, for this? And it's not just basketball. I mean, it's not just basketball. We're talking about all sports at every level. You can open up a gambling app and bet on a tennis match in the middle of the night that's on the other side of the world if you're in North America. So I just don't know how this gets slowed down, if it ever gets slowed down.
I agree with you. You know, I'm not a lawyer, by the way, so in case you say anything that's not possible, well, you know, it is what it is. But something I've thought a lot about is, like, you know, like there are certain arenas that have a sports book in the arena. I'm pretty sure the Wizards do and the Phoenix Suns do. Do the players get to take home a portion of the money bet when they're the ones playing in the games? And maybe it's like a part of the revenue distribution thing or whatever at the end of the year. You know, that's something I've wondered a lot about. Is there a way to collectively bargain some of this stuff, just because the players are the ones kind of putting their butts on the line on a nightly basis and are impacted by this, but everyone else is the one making money off of it? So I think that if you were to take, like, a sympathizer view with Jonte on that, if what he alleged is true, I think that's the argument for some of that, right? You know, if you can't beat him, join him in some way. So I don't know the answer. I don't know if there is one right now. I think discussing it or it being a conversation out there is maybe the first step to getting toward one. But to your point, I think the toothpaste is out of the tube. I think this is a new reality we live in. And I think the question becomes, how is there a way to control some of this, given which is easier said than done, given the exorbitant amounts of money people are making off of the gambling? You know, is there a way to regulate it better? Is there a way to control it better? And what does that all look like? I don't have any idea to any of the things I just brought up, but I think that is what needs to be addressed.
Alex, again, I feel like I'm asking you four questions in one here. What do you think? And again, this is just your opinion. You know, there's no way for you or Jonesy or myself to know truly the answer to this question. But in your opinion, what do you think is the ultimate outcome in the two scenarios? One scenario is he's innocent. He didn't do anything wrong. The NBA has its investigation. There was no wrongdoing. And Jonte Porter continues on with his career. And I think a lot of people are hoping that that's the case, even though this will probably still hang over him. But from some people that wonder still, oh, okay, well, is he truly innocent? But hopefully his name is cleared and he has a long career ahead of him. If it's found out that he's guilty, and again, unless it's guilty where there was some sort of crime or coercion involved where you actually, you know, you were the victim, that's a whole other scenario. But if it turns out again that he's, you know, guilty of this, is it a year's suspension from the league? Is it a lifetime ban? Like, how do you think the league, let alone the organization and the individual, navigates this depending on what the ultimate outcome actually is?
It's a good question. If he's innocent, I think that there needs to be a lot of transparency shown in terms of how is he innocent. Was it, like, as we discussed, is it all coincidence and some guy, you know, opened his app and was feeling lucky and put together a parlay and one big on Jonte. I think if he's innocent, I want to see a lot of transparency as to how it got there, given the allegations right now. I think that'd be in fairness to Jonte, too, to clear his name, if that's the case. If he's guilty, you know, I have a hard time seeing him play. I have a hard time seeing him play another game in the NBA just because I do think, especially if he, you know, again, depending upon where these allegations go, did he bet on himself? Did he instruct people to bet for him? None of that stuff is really pretty. So I think that you kind of have to, you know, him being what would be the first, I think you kind of have to throw the book at him. And I'd also say, you know, he's a player with injury history. He's a two-way player. You know, he could probably still go over and play in Europe, which might have ended up being the case for his career anyway. So I feel like, given, as we previously discussed, you know, where his stature is as a player in the NBA and versus the severity against the allegations, I feel like it's a lot easier to justify throwing the book at him if he is found guilty of all this than it is just giving him a fine or a suspension or anything that doesn't result in a ban of sorts. And again, if he is given a 3 or 4 year ban, I mean, I don't think it would necessarily impact his ability to come back to the NBA, but I mean, he might end up going over to Europe and staying there anyway in some capacity. So I feel like when you look at his career in context with the injuries and everything, and his stature, I feel like if he is found guilty, he probably has an example made out of him. And again, Adam Silver wants to expand the NBA into Las Vegas. He's talked about that a lot. You know, I think if you're Adam Silver, it's hard to kind of justify some of your future endeavors that you're very public about and then not come down hard on this in some capacity. You know what I mean? It'd be like having a set of rules for yourself and everybody else. And so I think that's why if he is found guilty, if he's innocent, the NBA needs to really open its books and show how that's the case. And if he's guilty, I think that given what the NBA has talked about doing in the near future, there needs to be some sort of adjustment given what's transpired.
Alex, it's going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds. We appreciate you joining us. Thanks for this.
Thank you guys for having me. I always love coming on with you guys.
That was Alex Schiffer, author and writer at Front Office Sports. And Jonesy, I'm going to ask you kind of a similar question to what I just asked Alex at the end there. What do you think ultimately happens if the allegations are true and if the investigation shows that Jonte Porter is guilty of, you know, betting on himself and placing wagers involving him, involving NBA games in general? Because I'm not sure that I sit on the fence on this, but what I'm trying to navigate is it an indefinite ban, indefinite suspension ban, whatever word you want to use? Is it a 1 year? Is it a lifetime? Because the closest thing I think we could maybe use as an example is, I don't know if we look to Pete Rose as the ultimate one. I think we look more towards the National Football League. And the National Football League in the last 5 years has had a couple of different cases where, and I looked it up here. Trust me, it's not like Jonesy, I have this off the top of my brain here. 2019, I can go back further. Like, I mean, we can go back to the 1960s and there was stuff involving Paul Hornung and Alex Karras, like way back in the day. But in recent memory, in the last 5 years, Arizona cornerback Josh Shaw suspended in November for gambling on an NFL game while he was on the injured reserve list. He hasn't played in the league since. 2022, Calvin Ridley, wide receiver who was with Atlanta at the time, suspended for the entire season, but has since come back. Played in Jacksonville last year, and actually I'm brain farting right now on where he just signed. Tennessee Titans, thank you. You know, what? On the ball with that one there. And we got to give a shout out to our crew when all is said and done on this one. But just signed with Tennessee, but he did come back in the league after missing a year. And Jonesy, there are a few others. Wide receivers coach Miles Austin with the Jets in 2022, suspended for a year for betting on non-NFL sports. And then there were a few last year. I'm not going to go through every single name, but in 2023, members of the Detroit Lions, members of the Washington Commanders suspended as well. Indianapolis Colts had one last June in the summertime with three separate players suspended indefinitely and the Colts waiving all three of those players right after it. And the list goes on. Like, so it's been happening more and more in the National Football League. In the last year, year and a half, there have been a ton of names. But in the last 5 years, we've gone from, as I said, dudes out for an entire year, but come back, and other guys that are suspended, and they've never been seen before again. So I'm not sure how this unfolds or how it kind of ends up with Porter if it turns out that the allegations are true.
Well, I'm not sure you can take away their livelihood. I'm not sure you can take away their, you know, their ability to make money. And you think if it was a big company, HR would provide some intervention, and yeah, there might be a suspension, a layoff, some behavior modification techniques used. So I don't know if it's a lifetime ban. Even Pete Rose, it was done. He should be able to be, I think, kind of reinstated into baseball, because we look at where it is now, it's part of everyday life, all of this gambling. And I think the thing to do is heavily establish the line between your participation, but yet not being one that does anything to aid or supplement any of the gambling that goes on around you. And as you just listed the number of people there, Eric, and the number of cases, it's sometimes hard. It's sometimes really hard. Now, the majority of the people aren't doing it, but you do have to deal with those people that have put their foot in the water the wrong way. So, I just think in this new era of the NBA, if there is something that's happening, they will deal with it sternly. But I don't know if you have the right to take away the man's livelihood. Maybe you do, and he can't play in the NBA, but he can go and play in Argentina or in South America somewhere, or in Europe somewhere, or in Southeast Asia somewhere. Like, he can still play. You just can't play here, right? If you're in a company, well, you lose your job for what you did here, but you still have that skill set. And if somebody else wants to hire you to do that job, that's fine. So, I guess that's where I stand on it, but it's a real slippery slope, you know, the same way that, guys had been suspended for cannabis and marijuana in the past. Now it's legal. So what happens to them? Does that stuff get expunged from their records? Just where do you go with it? It's a really, really tough question to deal with, Eric, and it's going to take, I think, some kind of compromise, give and take, to have a punishment, but yet at the same time, you know, not destroy somebody's ability to make money in their livelihood.
So the only thing I would say, Jonesy, maybe in return, and I don't know if you're going to agree or disagree, for me at least, and I'm not talking about Jontay Porter specifically, I'm talking about anybody in any sport. If you're betting on yourself, I think that's a problem. Even if you're betting for the over, I'm going to get more rebounds, I'm going to score more touchdowns, I'm going to hit more or get more RBIs, whatever it might be. Even if it's the over, I would hope you're going out there trying to do your best and score as much as you can and grab as many rebounds or steals or score as many touchdowns or whatever it might be. I would hope that's the case, but I still think it kind of brings into question then, what happens if the game is slightly out of hand and you have an opportunity to play more minutes, or you're actually going and taking a ball away from a teammate and grabbing a rebound that wasn't maybe going to be yours, or you're jacking up more shots just because you're trying to inflate your points per game or whatever. So even if you're betting the over, I think that's a problem if you're betting on yourself. Certainly if you're betting an under, I think that's a major issue. And especially if you're checking out of a game early and then you're wondering like, okay, is this person actually hurt or not? And again, I'm not using Jontay Porter specifically. I'm talking in generalities. So hence the reason I say if you're betting on yourself, I think that's an issue. If you're betting on your team to lose, that's an issue in any sport. If you're betting on your team to win, I don't think I have a problem with that, because you should be going out there to try and win every damn game. So if you're actually betting on your team to win, and that's what Pete Rose has alleged, if I'm not mistaken, for years, hey, man, I only ever bet on the Cincinnati Reds to win games. I only bet on my team to win. I don't have a problem with that. I really don't. But I guess the other line, if I continue to draw a line here, would be for me, if you're making wagers on other teams or other players, even within your own league or sport, I'm not sure that I have a problem with it as long as it's not your team or your opponent that night. It can't be a game you're involved in. And I certainly don't think that with the amount of gambling that is out there now and the amount of sponsorship that's out there and the fact that most, if not all, of the sports leagues are you know, aligned with and in bed with so many different gambling sites and companies and whatnot, I don't think you can tell a football player that they can't bet on basketball, or a basketball player that they can't bet on football, or a baseball can't bet on hockey, yada, yada, yada. It's like there's too many blurred lines now. It's out there too much. So to me, it's just your team and a game you're involved in against that opponent. Otherwise, in my mind, sorry to use the cliche, all bets are off then. I think it's fair game.
Yeah. I just think highly competitive people, they're going to be watching. I guess, where do you draw the line if I'm an NBA player and I went to school with Patrick Mahomes at Texas Tech, and I'm playing in the NBA, and he's my guy, and I think his team's going to win the Super Bowl, and you know, and I talk to him, and you know, little bits of information trickle out. Is that poisoning the waters? Does that taint the bet I make? If I don't talk to them and there's no information, I just say, hey, you know what? The Chiefs are going to win this, or the Commanders are going to win this because my boy who's on the offensive line, we went to school together, and you know, he says we're going to dominate them. And like just something as simple as that. Is that inside information? Is that wrong? You know, and listen, Eric, it brings to mind for me the words of, you know, former coaches that when they're asked about players playing, they just say, I don't know. It will be a game time decision. They may very well know that the guy's in or out, but they know there are gambling people out there. They know there are bets being put down on the game, and they refuse to give any information. I mean, Michael Grange talked about in his article how Bruce Brown's people just don't even ask him. They don't ask him because he's not going to tell them. And if everybody could be like that, this issue would be well under control. But it doesn't happen like that. And information trickles out. You know, we have an instance where, a coach was upset after losing a game, went to have a drink and said, you know, the next time we get these guys, we're going to do, and somebody overheard that and bet the game next time, hearing the coach talk to one of his assistants in a booth, and they won the bet. And they approached the coach after and said, hey, you know, we heard you lost to so-and-so, and we heard you talking about what you're going to do next time. We bet on you guys a second time when we won. Thank you very much. The coach had no idea. So it's out there. It's pervasive, especially in today's society. Where do you draw the line? And all you can do is try to regulate your own people that are involved and say, you can't do this, and try to keep reinforcing that.
Well, okay. I got to say one last thing. To your point about, like, where do you draw the line? This is where I don't get it, because both of these examples that I'm about to state are non-sports. They're more to do with the world of entertainment, and it's the Super Bowl. But Jones, you and I joke about this the last couple of years. It was a few years ago or a couple of years ago, the Super Bowl in LA, and on the Saturday night or something, like, yeah, granted, yes, the man could have walked back to his hotel room and shaved his face, or woken up in the morning and shaved before the Super Bowl, but there was a prop bet on whether or not Eminem was going to have a beard. Well, I saw the dude in an interview on Saturday night on, like, Entertainment Tonight or something, and he had a beard. That's the easiest bet in the world. I mean, if I had $1 million, I probably would have put it down. I think I put $2 down, and I won the bet. But anybody and their uncle could see that Eminem's got a beard, so unless I'm rolling the dice that he doesn't shave in the next 22 hours before he's on the field at halftime or something, he's going to have a beard. Like, what about every year when, whether it's Super Bowl or NBA All-Star game or whatever it is, you know, over under on the national anthem? Well, Jonesy, if you're a world-class singer and you and I are tight, and I go, Jonesy, if you do a minute 52, that's going to be over a minute 50. We could win a bunch of money here, man. Like, it's right out there. It's so, it would be so easy to see.
Yeah.
Like, I just don't understand where, to your point, where you draw the line. Then I don't get it.
I don't think you can draw the line, Eric. I don't think you can. There is no line. The line's blurred. It's vague. It's wiggly. There is no line. I think all you can do is continue to reinforce to the people in the discipline that's involved that you can't be part of this. And maybe the compromise is, yeah, if you're a hockey player, you can bet on everything but hockey. You can bet football, baseball, basketball, soccer, tennis. You can bet anything, but you can't bet our stuff. You can't do that. So
right.
It's I think it's difficult, but with the money involved, I just don't think that we are going to ever get to the point where, you know, as we talked about, this genie is going back in the bottle.
All right, let's step aside for the break. When we come back, we're going to shift our attention to the Canadian senior men's national team. We had a chance to chat with Jordy Fernandez last week on the show, but the president and CEO of Canada Basketball will join us this week, and he's coming up next, Michael Bartlett on Smith & Jones. Welcome back to Smith & Jones. Eric Smith, Paul Jones with you. I meant to do the shout-out going into the last break. I got to do it now, Jonesy, as we go into this next segment. I said shout-out the crew, but, you know, Austin Mackey was in my ear and on the ball when we were, you know, in that last segment talking about the NFL and giving me the goods on Calvin Ridley. And apparently it's because it's his team, the Tennessee Titans. Not so good these days, Austin, with the Tennessee Titans. But, you know, I'm still trying to get over the Music City Miracle from years ago. So I hate the Titans and will forever hate the Titans. But I digress. We'll move on now as we shift our attention away from, well, not just the NFL, but the NBA, and on to the Canadian senior men's national team, and heck, for that matter, the senior women's national team as well, and what should be and hopefully will be a very exciting summer for both programs, both competing in the Paris 2024 Olympic Games. Last week, we had Jordy Fernandez on the show, Jonesy, talking about the senior men's team, and just a few days ago, while down at Scotiabank Arena, we wanted to save this for you folks. We aired a portion of it, I believe, on one of our halftime shows, but we had a chance to talk at great length about a number of topics related to Canada Basketball with the president and CEO of Canada Basketball, Michael Bartlett.
Michael, we'll give people a portion of the part of the show that Eric and I normally have people pay for. But yeah. We'll let them in. We'll lift the curtain up. When the draw was going on for both the men and the women, you and I were texting back and forth, and nobody's ever happy with the draw, me included. But you pointed out some things on both sides that, and I guess for me, it's you changing the mentality. While I'm looking and saying, oh man, like we're gonna get, you know, we could get Spain on the men's side, and the women have France, and. You're saying, wait a minute, people are saying in their room, oh, my God, we got Canada.
That's exactly it.
It's a mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a mindset. And then, listen, I think there's a bit of a sorry mentality with Canadians, myself included, you know, quick to apologize, quick to think about the competition rather than thinking about what you mean to the competition. So what we're trying to do is adopt a mindset of we know in each one of those rooms as they saw the draw happen, their first thought is, oh, man, we got to get through Canada. And it's no longer us just being thankful to be there. Being in is no longer the win. We honestly believe we've got the talent, the rosters, the competitive advantages, the investments in coaching that we can go into all of these tournaments and be favored to get through to the medal round. And that's our goal. We want to be in games that matter in August competing for medals.
To that point, and I don't, you're close enough to me, you can punch me now, but what I think, and I feel like I maybe said this to you back in the summertime too, is because of the past, I'm still waiting for something bad to happen. And maybe that's just my mentality. Jonesy's known me long enough too where it's like, I like to say I'm a realist. I think I am a realist, but I get accused of being a pessimist. But a lot of bad things have happened to Canada. And then even in the summertime, you're like, here we go again.
Yeah, yeah.
But they came back, and they got that big win over the U.S. So I think even when it comes to the draw, you're like, you don't really realize how good this team is yet, or you're kind of taking that almost defeatist mentality because you're not ready yet to pump out your chest and go, no, but we are good.
We are them.
They should be
we are them.
Yeah. Worried about us.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, what's the term? Once bitten, twice shy. But when you've been 10 times bitten, you're just as, you know, even more shy. When you actually look at, and I unpacked this for somebody the other day that was talking about, you know, the basketball gods or the FIBA gods being against Canada. If that were the case, five America's teams wouldn't have lost in the afternoon just before we got a chance to play Spain. We wouldn't have been down 12 points to Spain and come back. The women wouldn't have needed a Spanish team who didn't even have to win the game to come back from 22. So let's stack up some of the FIBA good without really relying or thinking too much about how we've been bitten in the past and just start to think, like, if our rosters have changed, if our expectations have changed, if our investments of coaching has changed, maybe some of that good luck has changed too.
Can
I jump in with one other
thing? Yeah, sure.
I don't know if you guys were texting the same thing, but my initial reaction, and I'm not saying I'm right or smart or otherwise, but my instant reaction was, I know you couldn't get the U.S., but either way, no U.S.,
no Serbia.
No Germany.
Yeah.
At least two of those three would have been my two of my top three of, like, I want to avoid. To avoid all of them, it's like, well, you got to play somebody.
Yeah, same text chatter.
Yeah,
you know, as it came down to who we could get from pot A in both cases, men's and women's, we got teams that we believe we know we can compete with. We know at the, you know, when it comes down to it, in 10 games we can win more than half of those games. So now we just got to show up and win that one game in the tournament.
Yeah, and you know, Michael, we were talking, I look at the, in the men's bracket, the Olympic potential qualifiers, you know, my first thought was, oh boy, you're going to get Spain and Luka, or you know, you're going to get Spain and maybe Greece with Giannis.
Yeah.
But you know, I like the mindset. No, they've got to see us. They trot out on the floor and see red and white, and it's like, okay, this is an NBA team we're facing here. So, you know, the other part of it too, in talking with Jordy, is We did something last summer. Like, we put some breadcrumbs down. We turf marked an area that, like, we're medal contenders no matter where this thing goes.
Yeah, I think, listen, we can't walk into this tournament pretending like we've really done anything, but we know we've done something. And we recognize that with the right preparation, with the right, you know, matchups, with the right style of play, we know we've got the right athletes coming. We believe in the coaching staff, the men's and women's programs. All of those rights are going to put us in an advantage that we haven't had in Olympic Games ever before. So now let's go prepare as best as we can so that we can compete as best as we can. We're not standing here, and I'm not standing here today guaranteeing medals. What I am guaranteeing is we will be the most prepared with the most talented rosters and the best coaching than this country has ever been in an Olympic Games.
I looked at the women's draw the same way. We've been talking a lot about the men, but our women's team is, you know, they're higher ranked in the world rankings than our men's team. And I look at them the same way in that, all right, Australia, France at home. Yeah. But at the same point, I'm sure they're looking and saying Canada's no pushover. And, like, I think Victor is really, really building something on the women's side. When I look at especially the pipeline and the younger players coming up too, whatever's going to happen in 24 might be better in 28.
Yeah, very much so. You know, there's, you know, 240 Canadians playing Division A or Division One NCAA ball right now, and half of them are coming up through our women's pipeline. The talent is deep and rich and something that we can count on. What I do know is the style of play that Victor and our coaching staff has instilled into the women's program is a style of play that is truly uniquely Canadian. It is one that is physical. It is one that is, you know, high-flying and high-paced and also defensively minded. And that is going to shake teams up that play a more stoic European women's basketball system that you see. Now, listen, those systems have won for a number of years.
Yes.
But our system is going to disrupt people at the Olympics. We firmly believe that.
I know that you, let alone Canada basketball, has nothing to do with this, but the hotly rumored story about Toronto likely at some point, sooner than later, having a WNBA team, it's probably an obvious question and answer. But how important could that be for Canada basketball, for development, for young girls, for young women in this country, to have a team to look at and to see and to be able to be up close and personal with, like the Raptors.
Yeah, I think it can be another lightning rod for the popularity of the game, and specifically the popularity of the girls and women's game in this country, for sure. Ultimately, it is just one team, and it won't create now hundreds of opportunities for women and girls to be on the court in a professional setting. Just as important to having a WNBA franchise, much like a NBA franchise, is actually having a domestic league for women in this country. That will actually have the biggest lightning rod effect.
Eric's laughing because it's something we've been working together for 20 years, and I said in 2002 when we started working together as the commissioner of
Karma. I'm talking about the domestic league, and here comes the
CEBL just walks past us.
My guy, Mike Morreale.
The birth of a domestic pro league adds to a country's chances by continuing the development of talent, coaching, the pipeline, it filters down. I mean, you've got kids in Ottawa now, in Winnipeg, that want to play at a U Sports school because they can see playing pro in their hometown. We didn't have that before, and it is the next step for the women's team.
Yeah, and I think what gets lost in a lot of people, too, is we're not suggesting that that domestic pro league for women is a replacement opportunity for the WNBA. The reality of a women's pro basketball player, and we see it in our entire group of athletes. Bridget Carlton plays 6 months of the year in the WNBA and 6 months of the year over in Europe. She's a 365-day-a-year basketball player.
Right.
Imagine if she didn't have to travel to go play for a team in Hungary for those other 6 months. She can be a WNBA player for 6 months, and maybe she can be part of a domestic league in Canada for 6 months, earn that living, play highly competitive basketball, and then she's on home court and accessible for training more often than if she's over in Hungary. So it's just great for the entire national team program.
It's like all the kids from Florida and Texas that are in the NBA, the NFL, and Major League Baseball, because they could be year-round outside in the weather. Michael, can you kind of map out, I mean, I'm gassed up for Vegas July 10th, but can you kind of map out what the summer looks like for the men and the women before we ultimately tip it off?
I'll start with the women because they're going to get on court earlier. By mid-June, we're going to tip off training camp, phase one of training camp for the women in Edmonton, and then they're going to move on to Victoria. We'll conclude training camp there, and we've actually created some scrimmage opportunities. The Portuguese national team is going to come over, meet us in Victoria, and have some runs so that we can get some early prep. They'll then take a bit of a break and then convene flying over to Europe. They've got games scheduled in Belgium, games scheduled in Spain before they ultimately land in the Olympic Village in Lille. For the men, as you noted, we've got that signature game July 10th in the U.S. Or in Vegas against USA Basketball. We're actually going to convene training camp tail end of June here in Toronto. They will train then until probably July 7th or 8th. We'll travel down to Vegas. From Vegas, we're going straight over to Europe as well. We had aspirations of being able to host men's and women's games here leading into Paris. But the reality is most of the teams that have qualified for the Olympics are European teams. It was pretty tough to get them to come over here. Yeah. What I can promise you, in 2028, we're going to have a Canadian caravan of games across the country before we head down to L.A. for that Olympics. And, yes, I'm already assuming that we've qualified for those Olympics.
We're in.
So we'll head over to France, actually, from Vegas. We've got a number of scrimmage games planned there. Hopefully a few more on television on Sportsnet, too. And then ultimately we will move the men's team into the Village in Lille as well.
Speaking of the men's team, we started talking about them. I don't want to put words in Jordy's mouth. Jonesy, tell me if I'm wrong and misrepresenting what Coach said on our last edition of Smith and Jones. Has the mentality or the mandate changed at all from when you and Nick Nurse first talked about the 3-year commitment to where we're at now? Because obviously new head coach, and hey, things have changed with certain players, with injuries, with availabilities. Are we still locked into 3 years, or could that kind of be tweaked and altered as we look ahead to this summer, let alone beyond?
You know, I think ultimately the core commitment is still the core commitment. There's a lot that we don't control, and Jordy referenced it in the media avails he did before the game on Wednesday night. You know, whether it be injury or something to that effect, we'll have to look at all cards. What I do know from speaking with Jordy and speaking with Rowan, who have been talking to the guys, you know, on every stop through the league, everybody has indicated their interest in being a part of it. So what does that mean? That means we've got a great group of guys that are interested in the way that this program is progressing. Whether or not that plays out for Paris or plays out past Paris into the LA Quad, what we are growing right now is a committed group of men and women. The women have always showed their commitment, that are willing to put their summer or their personal life aside to compete for their country. I think what you'll see is for the men, they built something special as a group of individuals that became a team. Not a lot will be done to mess with that team environment and team mentality. Are there little tweaks that we could make here or there depending on player availability? Yeah, there certainly are. But I think everybody is hyper-conscious to the fact that we built something special with that team, and that could be a differentiator for us heading into a key matchup against a country that might just, for lack of a better term, put an all-star team together, and it doesn't necessarily become a sum of its parts.
Yeah. Michael, I mean, that's a difficult decision, not just for Jordy on the men's side, but for Victor, too, on the women's side. Like, there is a group of players, and it's about getting the right mix and the right chemistry. And, I mean, we've talked about this before. How many people get – they build the car for you, but they don't get a ride in it when it's time because you're going – I wouldn't say you're going a different direction. You're just going with a different mix, and that's tough.
You know, that's national sports, though, because we're not in the World Cup to then make sure that we're in the Olympics without 17 guys cycling through on a winter core roster that never even got a shot to go to the World Cup and certainly aren't going to get a shot to go to the Olympics. And the same happens in the women's environment. The players that are playing for you in any given window, it's rare that it's consistent. You do not get 3 years of a team. You do have to cycle through. So it is a fact of national sports that sometimes you're in, sometimes you're not. What we're trying to be, though, is a program that regards everybody who played a role in it as being celebrated as creating the outcome that may ultimately be created by 12, but it was 36 people that got us there. So we've got to pay special attention to that.
When you took over, if you can kind of even give me like just kind of slight overview, unless you want to share some secrets, where we are right now, where you stand. Are you at where you thought / knew you wanted to be? Are you ahead of it? Are you behind it? Like, from your standpoint when you took over?
Yeah, from my standpoint, the board and the executive team made it very clear that heading into Paris, we wanted to have at least two, if not three, teams qualified for the Olympics, and four would be a bonus. We are currently at two, with the women's 3x3 team and the men's 3x3 team still having their shot to qualify in May. So I'd say we're where we want it to be. But ultimately, like, and I make no bones about it, and my good friend and your friend Dave DeFreitas would call me out on it if I pretended to have anything to do with the basketball part of it. My hope and time and energy and ambition was always spent to make sure that Canada rallied around this team from a fandom standpoint, from a commercial standpoint, from a philanthropy standpoint, from a government funding standpoint, so that we could have no more excuses when it came to investing in the competitive advantages. That's the best way that we can help the basketball team achieve its 2-for-4, 3-for-4, or perhaps even 4-for-4 teams going to the Olympics. Because ultimately, if we can invest in those competitive advantages, what we did know is we had the talent. We knew we had the talent to do whatever we wanted once we got there. But we had to be able to get there. And that was going to take a lot more money than we've ever invested in the basketball aspect of our operations. And thankfully, because Canada has gotten behind this team, commercial Canada and fandom Canada has gotten behind this team, along with the government funding that we've been able to achieve and attract over the last number of years, we've been able to turn that into the outcomes that we always knew were possible.
Okay, last one for you, and you led into it perfectly. This is your chance to speak to. You just announced last week a new partner.
Yeah.
Where are we at financially? I mean, I'm sure you always want more, could use more, but, like, if people wanted to get involved, I mean, this is your chance, I guess, to pitch to folks to some extent.
Well,
like, where do things stand?
Here's what I believe we are becoming. As an organization, we're an organization you can trust. You can have a lot of fun with this organization because we are, for 2 weeks this Olympic period, I think, going to be the story of the Olympic Games for Canada and perhaps even story of the Olympic Games for the world. So what we need is Canada not to just pay attention 2 weeks out of every four when we're in the Olympics. We need Canada corporately, from a government funding standpoint, philanthropists, anyone that wants to be behind this team and feel like they're helping build Canada's basketball teams that aren't the Toronto Raptors, but are actually Canada's basketball teams made up of 12 Canadians every time they hit the court. Now's the time to lean in because there are opportunities, whether we're doing fan trips to Vegas, whether we're doing corporate partner initiatives, whether we're doing donor programs. Like the other night, all of our donors to the program actually got to be part of the panel that you were at, Eric, where our coaches broke down the draw. These are the types of fun things that we can do, that we want to do with our key supporters, and now's the time to lean into Canada basketball, not just every 4 years for a two-week period.
Awesome. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was the president and CEO of Canada Basketball, Michael Bartlett. Again, we had a chance to have that conversation a few days ago down at Scotiabank Arena, but we wanted to play it for you for the first time in its entirety on this latest edition of Smith and Jones. Thanks again to Alex Schiffer for joining us on the show, as well as Michael Bartlett, and to producer and technical director Austin Mackey. Big thanks to him as well. Folks, make sure you subscribe to Smith and Jones wherever you get your podcast, Google, Apple, Spotify, or otherwise. Download, subscribe, rate, review, and please share it as well. And we're back every Thursday with fresh content. Another edition of Smith and Jones coming up in another 7 days. We appreciate you tuning in. Have a good one, folks.